KIOS-FM proudly presents another luncheon broadcast from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, November 9th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Today's guest speaker will be Robert Janetsky, one of the nation's premier interest rate forecasters and investment advisors, and president of Robert Janetsky & Associates, Incorporated. His remarks were given as the keynote address at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce 2004 Economic Outlook Luncheon. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Rod Cherney, President and Chief Investment Officer of Kirkpatrick Pettist Investment Management, Incorporated, one of the sponsors of today's luncheon.
Dr. Robert Janetsky has been named the number one interest rate forecaster nationwide by both Institutional Investment Magazine and Blue Chip Financial Forecasts. Dr. Janetsky is well known for his advocacy of classical economic principles that provide a reliable guide to creating both a healthy economy and profitable investment opportunities. He has conducted pioneering research on the role of taxes and their impact on economic prosperity. In the early 1980s, he correctly forecast that tax cuts would end the nation's economic ills. And that was a great idea. Dr. Janetsky has authored numerous articles and several books, including the influential Taking the Voodoo Out of Economics. In his latest book, A Nation of Millionaires, Janetsky provides his vision of the changes in government policies that will shape the economic and financial landscape in the 21st century. Dr. Janetsky earned his PhD in economics from New York University. He has taught economics at New York University and at the University of Chicago's Graduate School of Business. Now, please join me in welcoming our keynote speaker, Robert Janetsky.
Thank you, Rod. Really, really appreciate it. It's a great opportunity to be here to talk about the economy, financial markets, and is without a doubt one of the most exciting and yet at the same time one of the most troubling times. We've got a lot to cover, and let me tell you how I'd like to conduct the presentation. I'd like to begin by giving you a quick summary of all the major conclusions that I'm going to reach. I like to do this so those of you who like to put economists in particular categories can put me in whatever category you want to put me in right off the bat. Then I'm going to spend the bulk of the presentation developing what I call a framework that I would use for arriving at the particular conclusions, and then I'll finish up by quickly summarizing the key points that I want to leave you with. But before I even get started, I like to let people know just a little bit about myself. For the past quarter century, I've been presenting myself as one of the most optimistic economists and investment advisors you could find anywhere in the country, perhaps anywhere in the world. Now, people who are familiar with economists are not necessarily impressed when I claim to be one of the most optimistic, because as a group, we economists tend to be pretty dull, pretty boring, not the kind of people you want to invite to a party if you want that party to be a success. One of my favorite descriptions of an economist is someone who loves to play with numbers, but never quite had the personality to make it as an accountant. But even among the handful of happy-go-lucky economists that happen to be out there, I've happened to be one of the happiest, one of the go-luckiest. And the reason for that is my belief that there are some powerful forces at work and have been at work for the past quarter century, pressuring economic policymakers to adopt sound economic policies, whether they want to or not. And as a result of those policies, we have generally enjoyed good, sound economic fundamentals. They've spread around the world, and we've had an increase in prosperity and living standards, both here and abroad. We've also, of course, had some problems. In the past couple of years, those problems have been quite a few. And I believe those problems stem from mainly three things: the Federal Reserve, some policy mistakes on the part of the administration and Congress, and three, of course, the terrorist attack and the threat of additional terrorist attacks. My overall conclusion is that all of these three factors have turned around in a very positive direction to help encourage economic recovery. They did that a year ago. We've had a good economic recovery in spite of a sharp rise in energy prices. And we're going to continue to have a strong economic recovery in the year ahead. My conclusion is that real growth is going to be somewhere in the vicinity of 5%, among the fastest that we've seen in the past 20 years over the course of the next year. Inflation will be about 2%. Interest rates are artificially low, so they'll be going up. And my expectation is in the short-term area, we'll see somewhere between a 2 and a 3 percentage point increase in short-term interest rates over the course of the next year or two. In the long-term area, I believe interest rates are going to go up 1 to 2 percentage points from where they are right now. And with respect to the stock market today continues to be significantly undervalued based on current economic conditions for reasons that I'll go into. Since economic conditions are going to continue to improve, and with the policies that I expect to see in the second Bush administration, we will further strengthen the fundamentals in the future. We have only seen what I believe is the first stage of what could prove to be one of the most sustained and encouraging bull markets in all of history. So for those of us who have spent the past few years seeing so many 401ks turn into 201ks, there are better days ahead. That's my quick overview. Let me go in now to develop the framework. And let me begin by asking your help on this. I'd like a show of hands. How many here have had the opportunity to listen to Alan Greenspan, the head of the Federal Reserve Board, talk about the economy? Show of hands, even on TV, anywhere. Great. Another show of hands. As a result of listening to him, how many got the idea that economics could be a difficult subject to understand? I usually raise both hands, and that's unfortunate because, in essence, economics is really pretty straightforward. The essence of economics is how do you get people to put resources together in the most efficient way possible to produce the things that other people want? And it turns out economists figured that out a couple of hundred years ago when the classical economists wrote. And classical economists said, hey, people will naturally put resources together in the most efficient way possible to produce things that other people want so long as they have the right environment. And the right environment, according to the classical economists, consisted of only four things, what I call the four classical principles. They said you have to give people low tax rates, you have to let them operate with free markets, you have to protect their property rights, and you have to give them a stable currency with which to transact business. I like to point out to people that one of these principles is a lot older than a couple of hundred years. The idea that low tax rates make sense, that's thousands of years old. When I go back to the Old Testament, you can find out that even God doesn't ask for more than 10% of our income. Well, let's think about that. Shouldn't that make us wonder who some of these politicians must think they are when they ask for more than 10% of our income? Oh, basically, what we've found is that over the course of the past 200 years, the classical economists got it absolutely right. Whenever we have seen, whether in this country or any other country, policymakers move policies in the direction of these classical principles, we've had economic prosperity. Conditions have improved. And whenever we've seen them move away from these principles, we've had disappointing economic developments. And the reason for my optimism in the past quarter of a century is my belief that there are powerful pressures to persuade policymakers to adopt classical economic principles. And these pressures are essentially the computer chip, the telecommunications revolution, the spread of democracy throughout the world. And here's the way it works. We all know in our businesses that the computer chip has helped us to measure things better than we've ever been able to measure them before. The same thing is true in economics. With the help of the computer chip, we've had an outpouring of economic research and studies that have basically verified the classical economic principles. We've had studies, my own studies have shown that with respect to taxes, when we cut key tax rates in the economy, tax rates related to the creation of wealth, we end up increasing output in the economy by 2 to 3 times the magnitude of the revenue that was estimated to be lost from those tax cuts. And vice versa, when we increase key tax rates, we end up destroying 2 to 3 times the wealth and income creation potential in the economy. We've also had studies of the efficiency of government. And although government people don't like the results of these studies, what they show is the government is basically half as efficient as the private sector. If you spend a dollar in the private sector, you get a dollar's worth of value on balance, sometimes more, sometimes less. In the government sector, when you spend a dollar, research shows you get 50 cents worth of value, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. So all of the research has consistently shown the classical economists knew what they were talking about. Telecommunication revolution means that anyone with a laptop anywhere in the world has access to all this research. And the spread of democracy means that one country after another, as people get control of their future, they demand that policymakers adopt the type of policies that will bring about prosperity. And that's what we've seen in the past quarter of a century. The most dramatic improvement and spread of classical principles throughout the world that we have seen at any point in our history. From Eastern Asia, classical principles spilled over into China. They've gone into India. Eastern European countries have adopted the principles. Russia is adopting these principles. And we're seeing spectacular growth and increases in income in all those areas. Interesting aside, one of my former bosses ended up being the chief economist under President Reagan. And he tells me in the early 1980s, he visited China, spoke to all the leaders of the Chinese government at that time. He said, "Bob, you wouldn't believe it. Back on the bookshelf of every one of them were the classical economic textbooks." And you know what they did? They told me, they pointed to those textbooks, and they said, "You know, these guys had it right, and this is where we're going to take China over the course of the coming decades." Today, China is the second most powerful economy in the world, second only to the United States. Classical economics principles work. But nowhere have they been applied more extensively in any developed country of the world than here in the United States. Here's a chart of tax rates in the United States. You can see where they were in 1981. This is a series that I created. They were up close to 40%. They are now down to about 25%. And currently, under current law, at the end of the decade, they click back up again, but you can see the trend over the course of the past 2 decades. Same thing has happened with respect to capital gains taxes. They were close to 50% in 1978. They're now down to 15%. Major, dramatic moves in the direction of classical economic principles. We've also had a reduction in trade barriers. We've had a reduction in regulatory burdens relative to the economy. We had until recently a slowdown in government spending, and the end result was a huge increase in productivity. Now, what does that mean? Well, when productivity increases, it means the efficiency with which we operate increases, and it means living standards go up. My estimate today is that productivity is increasing at a rate of about 3%. In addition to that, if we add workers, we have the potential to increase output by about 4% per year. That's in the envy of the rest of the world. But why do we run into trouble then? Well, just because we have the potential to create 4% more output doesn't mean that that's how much we create. Basically, how much more we create in any one year depends on how much more spending we do. If we spend 4% more each and every year, we're capable of increasing output 4% per more. We grow 4%, and eventually there's zero inflation because there's no room for inflation. If we spend 6% more money each year than the previous year, and we're capable of producing 4% more output, we end up with 2% inflation. If we spend less than 4%, we have a slowdown, and if it's enough less, we have a recession. So that raises the question, well, what causes spending to go up 4% or 6%, 2%? My answer to that is the main reason is the Federal Reserve Board. The Federal Reserve Board was created in 1913 and given a very unique power, the power to create money out of thin air. There are only two groups I know of that have that power. One is the Federal Reserve, the other is counterfeiters. We put counterfeiters in jail. We take the head of the Federal Reserve and turn him into a folk hero in front of the TV cameras. But they both basically have the same function. It's important to understand how the Fed goes about this. What they do is, in essence, they write checks, big checks, $1 billion at a time. They don't have a dime in the bank. The question is, who in their right mind would cash a check, especially for $1 billion, with someone who doesn't have a dime in the bank? And the answer, of course, is the Fed is the banker's bank. They're the ones that get the check. Well, they take the check, they say, yes, this is good. And what they tell the people then is, you now have new reserves, bank reserves, on deposit with us. And that's the first step in the monetary process, the creation of bank reserves. The more bank reserves that are created, there is a tendency for there to be more money created in the economy. The more money is created, the more spending you end up with. From time to time, the Fed makes a mistake. This next chart shows the pattern of bank reserves that have been created. Throughout the 1990s, the Fed did a great job. We had spending seldom going below 4%, above 6%. 1999, the Fed made a mistake. What they did is they poured bank reserves into the economy in 1999. They had a 40% increase, huge increase. What that did is that created a boom in the economy, a boom in the stock market, and it created the bubble that we hear so much about. Why did they do it? Well, they were afraid that Y2K would create some problems for the economy. When the year 2000 came, Y2K was not a problem. Fed looked around. Spending was now going up at a 7% rate. That was going to lead to higher and higher inflation. Fed members looked at each other, met in Washington, and said, whoops, we made a mistake. And they spent the year 2000 taking all those reserves back out of the economy. That's what caused the stock market to finally come to a halting stop, start to go down, and the next year, with the normal lags in the economy, we had the recession of 2001. Finally, by the spring, the Fed got its act together, started putting reserves back into the economy, and as you can see here, bank reserves have been growing at a rate of 5% ever since, and so what we have is we have monetary policy lifting the economy up. The economy didn't start as rapidly in 2002 as it should have. We had a slow start to the recovery because we had some problems. One of those problems was our federal government got involved. The Congress, the administration, looked around at the recession that had occurred in 2001 and said, we got to do something. What are we going to do? One thing they did, they put tariffs on steel coming into the economy. That's a move away from classical economic principles. You have the Sarbanes-Oxley bill that sent businessmen running around to their lawyers and accountants trying to figure out, what do I have to do to stay out of jail? But the thing that really did it is they decided to increase government spending dramatically to help the economy. Now, I don't blame politicians entirely for this, because there are actually some economists that tell politicians it's a good idea to increase government spending. It helps the economy. To me, that's like telling Bill Clinton, you got a bunch of college co-eds outside just dying to meet you. It's not a good idea. Not a good idea at all. Remember, when you increase government spending, basically what you end up doing is you end up destroying half the value of the money that's spent. So we had a very slow recovery in 2002. Fortunately, last year, in the middle of the year, tax rates were cut significantly. Biggest tax cut we've had, key tax rates since the early 1980s, and what followed was the fastest economic growth since the early 1980s. That's what has always happened when you have tax cuts. It doesn't happen because you put money in the pockets of individual people. That's not why you get a stimulus in the economy. Because remember, for every dollar the government gives you in a tax cut, it's got to take that dollar out of someone else's pocket by selling them bonds. So there's no short-term stimulus to speak of from tax cuts. The stimulus comes because if you cut the right tax rates, you create a greater incentive to create income, to create wealth. That's the way key tax rates work on the economy. We've had that growth this past year, and that growth is going to continue in the coming year because those tax rates are staying in effect. The third factor is the threat of a terrorist attack. We already know last time, 9/11, the effect that a terrorist attack can have on the economy. It's devastating. So a key question is, how vulnerable are we to another major terrorist attack? My belief has been all along that we have significantly reduced the threat of another major terrorist attack. Basically, we were sucker punched in 9/11. We didn't realize the nature of the enemy, what was going on. There's several things that we now believe we know. One, there's a major war going on in Islam between the fanatics who want control and are willing to kill anyone who stands in their way, including fellow Islams, and the moderates who would just as soon be peaceful and live and let live. We also now believe we know that there were some 20,000 terrorists trained in Afghanistan in al-Qaeda's training camps. We also believe we know that there are tens of thousands of additional fanatics in the Mideast who hate us with such a passion they're willing to kill us and themselves in order to accomplish their objectives. And finally, we believe we know that if the status quo in the Mideast continues, that a generation or two from now, there will be 10 times that number of fanatic terrorists out to do us harm and willing to kill themselves. So really, the war on terror is a two-front war. The first front is dealing with the terrorists, the 20,000 terrorists and their leaders who were trained in Afghanistan. The second front is trying to change the status quo in the Mideast so a generation or two from now, our kids and grandkids aren't faced with a problem that's 10 times more serious than the one we're faced with today. President Bush's approach was stated right after 9/11. Basically, he said countries have to decide they're either with us or they're with the terrorists. And secondly, that terrorists should have no place to hide, and any country that harbors terrorists, gives them sanctuary, will be considered as guilty as the terrorists themselves. And the war in Afghanistan and now the war in Iraq is all designed to accomplish both the first and the second front in winning the war on terror. The idea of whether or not we can change the status quo in the Mideast is still something that's open. President Bush believes, I believe, if you spread freedom and democracy to that part of the world, if you can achieve stability in Iraq with the constitution they now have, which incidentally is based on classical economic principles, you have the potential for changing the dynamic in the Mideast. If you change the dynamic in the Mideast, it becomes more difficult for the fanatics to blame the U.S. for everything that goes wrong. They know this. That's why they're all going into Iraq now from all around the area to try and prevent Iraq from succeeding. Because if Iraq succeeds, it's going to change the whole status quo in the Middle East. I also believe that so long as terrorists are on the run, so long as they're hiding, so long as they're fighting our military over there, so long as the biological laboratories that were in Iraq have been destroyed, it becomes far more difficult for them to plan their damage here in the U.S. And as a result, I believe the odds of a major terrorist attack continue to fall. So you put all these three things together: expansive monetary policy, movement in the direction of classical principles with tax cuts, and a reduction in the threat of a major terrorist attack. Putting all three of those together, that's why I believe we had the strong recovery of the past year. A recovery, incidentally, that occurred in spite of a huge increase in energy prices, which really held it back a little bit. All those forces continue to be in effect, and that's my rationale for believing we will have another good year for the economy with strong, rapid economic growth. What about inflation? Inflation, I believe, is going up. I think the Fed has been a little too easy, too expansionary. One of the things that I would suggest you look at is gold prices. You can see here gold prices are about 20% or more above their average of the past 4 years. That's usually an indication that the Fed is putting too much money into the system and is going to send inflation a little bit higher. Similar thing can be gleaned from the value of the dollar, which is very low at the current time. When we produce more dollars than foreign countries are producing currencies, it tends to depress the dollar. As a result, I believe inflation will be going up. This is my chart of where inflation is likely to go. I think it's going to go up somewhere in the 2% vicinity. I know it's been there all along because of energy prices, but even if energy prices come down, I think it's going to continue to be there. What does all this mean for interest rates? Currently, short-term interest rates are artificially low. Even after tomorrow's increase, short-term rates are going to assume that inflation is going to be below 1%. It's been 2%. It's going to be 2%, so these rates have to go up higher. And my belief is they'll be going up 2 to 3 percentage points. In terms of the long-term area, we'll have 1 to 2 percentage points of an increase because they currently assume long-term inflation is going to be a little over 1%. Finally, the stock market. I did an analysis last year based on profits, which have been very good, and interest rates. And my analysis a year ago concluded that the stock market was 30 to 35% undervalued. That was actually in May of 2003. If you're interested in that analysis, because it gets very detailed, you can find it on my website, classicalprinciples.com. Basically, what has happened since then is the market's up about 35%, but profits are up about 35%. So the market remains significantly undervalued at the current time. About a year ago, about the time I was doing this study, a good friend of mine, a very bright guy with a lot of assets, told me he was getting all of his assets out of the stock market. And I said, why? He said, the risk is simply too great. He said, do you know what would happen if a terrorist let off a nuclear bomb in downtown Manhattan? Do you know what would happen to Manhattan? Do you know what would happen to my stock portfolio if that were to happen? He said, I cannot tolerate that sort of risk. And what I tried to point out to him, well, you realize that risk has always been there. That's a risk for never doing anything, never getting involved in the stock market, never starting a business. I said, that risk is one of the reasons that on balance, stocks have returned 9% per year. I said, it's my view that the risks associated with holding stocks have always been there, always will be there, whether it's a terrorist attack or some natural disaster. Those risks are far greater when stocks are significantly overvalued, when there's a lot of excess optimism, when the Fed is tightening monetary policy, sending short-term interest rates above long-term interest rates, when government policies are moving away from classical principles toward higher tax rates, more regulation, more government spending. And those risks are not nearly so great when we have the conditions that exist today. As a result, it's my belief that the stock market today continues to be well undervalued. But the stock market's future value really looks ahead. What sort of policies are we likely to encounter over the course of the next year or two? Here's where the recent election makes such a difference in terms of where we're headed. I look at President Bush in his first term and what he accomplished. And what he accomplished, although he's got conservatives mad at him in some cases, liberals mad at him in other cases, what he accomplished is nothing short of amazing. What he did in a whole lot of areas, basically what I would call losing the battle or compromising away the battle to win the war. One example of this is tariffs on steel. In return for putting this tariffs on steel, he got passed in Congress by one vote, fast-track trading authority. As a result of that authority, we now have free trade agreements with Australia, Singapore, and Chile that were passed and approved over the course of the past year. And in addition, the steel tariffs came off. And he's about to enter into another worldwide trade agreement, further taking down the barriers to trade. Those are moves in the direction of classical economic principle. On taxes, he compromised. How did he compromise? We had major tax cuts last year. The compromise was that they would expire toward the end of the decade. What that means is that all the tax rates, the key tax rates, capital gains, marginal tax rates, the estate tax, all end toward the end of the decade. It's interesting. The death tax gradually goes down and finally is eliminated in 2010, about 5 years from now. But then in 2011, it comes back at the highest possible rates. Which has led people to suggest, you know, gee whiz, if you really want to leave a big estate, you want to die in 2010. As a result of President Bush's election, one of the first things he's going to do is make those tax cuts permanent so you don't have to die in 2010. You can die whenever you feel like dying. One of the key things he's also done is to introduce health savings accounts. I'm really impressed by these health savings accounts. I have one myself. This is the idea, if you're not familiar with it, where instead of buying a traditional $9,000 a year insurance policy, you get $5,000 into your own account, all tax-free, to use on everyday medical expenses, and the other $4,000 goes to pay for catastrophic insurance in case your bills run above the $5,000 a year. I'm just taking hypothetical numbers. Actually, they're the numbers that apply to me that I'm taking here. There are studies that were done on these type of accounts about a decade ago that show, on balance, people save roughly half on their medical expenses when they have these accounts, when it's their own money. My own experience just recently, when I had my checkup, which I had to pay for out of my own health savings account, and my doctor recommended a test. And he signed me up for the test, and I called because of my curiosity. I said, by the way, how much does this test cost? They said, oh, $2,000. I said, $2,000? Gee, sounds awfully high, and it's coming out of my account. So I quickly went on the internet and found that this test normally runs $500 to $1,500. I then called some places and ended up scheduling it for $750. This is what they found on a wide-scale basis. And we spend $1.5 trillion a year on health care. There is the potential, as these accounts gain popularity, that we will end up saving hundreds of billions of dollars in terms of controlling health care costs. And, of course, the two biggest items that the president has talked about is revamping the whole tax system in some dramatic way. And some people have talked about maybe eliminating the IRS and having a national sales tax. And the second basic idea is reforming Social Security so individuals can take a portion, maybe a large portion, of their current contributions and put them into an account of their own so they have control of that. Both of these moves would be in the direction of classical principles. I want to quickly say that as a result of looking at what President Bush has done in his first term, what he often does is not grab for the ideal, which often in our society is politically unattainable, but what he does is he grabs for the good that moves us in the direction of the ideal. As a result of that, I don't expect we'll see the end of the IRS. I wouldn't hold my breath that we'll see the end of the IRS in the course of the next 4 years. But I believe we will see a more simplified tax system that works us in that direction. And as we go out further into this century, I believe we will see the end of the IRS. And I believe we will also see a move toward private Social Security to replace the current Social Security system. All of that is a movement in the direction of classical principles. All of it means that we have a significant opportunity for not only an extended period of economic recovery, but also one of the most sustained bull markets in our history. I wanted to make sure I left time for questions, so let me just stop there and ask if we can make sure we have time for questions and answers. Okay.
Thank you, by the way.
Okay, thank you.
If you have questions and you've written them on your card and they've not been collected, hold them up and chamber staff will be collecting them. I've got one softball for you, just to get the ball rolling. You project increases in spending for every major sector in the economy. Are there any unusual patterns or differences this time versus other rebounds?
No. The question is, which sectors of the economy are likely to be the strongest? I don't think there's going to be much of a difference this time as opposed to last time. We've already seen the strength in housing. That's the early sector that booms during the recovery. As the recovery gets going, interest rates go up. Housing sector tends to level off and the strength starts to be in business investment. We've had pretty strong business investment. I think that that's going to continue. But I don't see any major shift in one direction or another from
okay.
this point on.
Can you comment on the deficit and its impact on the economy?
Yeah, I gave a whole economic speech without mentioning one word about the deficit. And I did that for a good reason. I do not believe that the deficit gives us any significant information whatsoever about where the economy is headed or whether things are good or bad. The principles of debt are really the same whether we're dealing with individuals, whether we're dealing with companies, or whether we're dealing with government. And the principles of debt are that debt is neither good nor bad. The one thing I would ask you to remember is that not all debt is created equal. You know that from your own individual experiences. When you go out and borrow money for a mortgage, it ends up being probably, in most cases, the best debt people have ever incurred in their entire life. Companies go out all the time and borrow money for expansion. On occasion, they make mistakes. The government can make a mistake, too. And a deficit can either be the consequence of a good or a bad policy. Let's take an increase in wasteful government spending. If government increased spending wastefully, and the deficit goes up, the increase in the deficit is a consequence of a bad policy. But what if the government had a surplus and it has a huge wasteful increase in spending? That's also a bad policy. The bad policy isn't the deficit increase. The bad policy is the wasteful spending. Similarly, with respect to cutting tax rates. I mentioned my research that showed that when you cut tax rates, key tax rates related to the creation of wealth, you end up getting an increase 2 to 3 times that magnitude in terms of wealth in the economy. So a deficit that increases because you've cut taxes is not the reflection of a bad policy. In fact, it's often the reflection of a very wise government policy. The one thing I've told people, there are only two types of debt that I believe you should worry about. One is your own debt, and second is the debt of anyone you've loaned money to.
Great answer. Thank you. Here's a good one. Have the classical economists ever been wrong?
Absolutely not. Now, the principles of economics are basically the same throughout time. I used to get a big kick out of going through the old economics textbooks in the 50s. There was one that was used when I was in school. It was Samuelson. And at one point, I went through every edition of Samuelson, found out how economics changed with every edition. Depending upon which edition you happen to be taught with, you were taught something totally different. That's nonsense. Economic principles are the same. That's why I go back to the classical principles. They've been around for 200 years. They basically incorporate what happens with human nature. You make things more attractive, people tend to behave in a different way. Now, can you make a mistake in forecasting? Of course. Things can happen out of the blue. The latest hurricane knocked an awful lot of the oil production in the Gulf out of commission. It sent energy prices skyrocketing higher than they otherwise would have been. Unless you could forecast the hurricane and what effect it was going to have on oil production in the Gulf, you're going to make a big mistake with respect to a forecast of energy prices. So those type of mistakes get made. The type of mistakes regarding human behavior, no.
Okay, terrific. You just mentioned escalating energy prices. What is your forecast for oil and gas stocks over the next 3 years as compared to overall U.S. stock market?
I believe that the prices have gone way, way out of line relative to long-term fundamentals. At $30 a barrel, shale oil starts to become economically viable. And we've got essentially what is an unlimited supply. That's the shale rock that they turn into oil. So anything in the vicinity of $30 a barrel brings on so much new production that basically we get swamped with energy. So it's my view that the prices here are up here temporarily for very unusual reasons, and as time goes on, over the next 2 or 3 years, we will see these prices come back down probably somewhere to the $30 to $40 a barrel range.
Okay. Should the government subsidize the failing airline industry, And I guess as a secondary question, should failing businesses be allowed to renege on pension promises?
That's a tough one. I don't believe the government should be involved in subsidizing businesses. And in terms of bankruptcy reorganization, I think you have to be very careful in terms of general principles of reorganization not to come out with a situation where you end up hurting whatever viable businesses are left in that area. I think perhaps you should allow some of these firms to go bankrupt. In many cases, they've overpromised in terms of pension benefits, in terms of salaries, and if that drives them into bankruptcy, then perhaps their assets should be sold, divided up among the other companies, and you go on from there. But I would be very careful about allowing companies to get away with bad decisions. I think it sets a bad precedent.
Final question. Will the value of the dollar ever equal the value of the euro? And if so, what are the implications?
Well, yeah, it has and it will again at one time or another. I mean, the value of the dollar was down relative to the euro. It was above the value of the euro, then it went down. It'll go back up again. The key factor here tends to be monetary policy. The more expansive our monetary policy is, the more checks the Fed writes, the more we pump dollars into our economy relative to what they're doing in Europe, the further the value of our dollar falls. Eventually, as we raise interest rates, as we get our monetary policy under control, interest rates will go up, and the value of the dollar will go up. How far it goes up really depends not just on what we do, but also on what the European Central Bank does.
Terrific. Bob, thank you very much. We appreciate it.
You've been listening to a broadcast from the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce. Today's guest speaker has been Robert Janetsky, one of the nation's premier interest rate forecasters and investment advisors, and president of Robert Janetsky & Associates, Incorporated. His remarks were given as the keynote address at the Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce 2004 Economic Outlook Luncheon. This program was recorded by KIOS-FM on Tuesday, November 9th, 2004, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jane McCain, Greater Omaha Chamber of Commerce Events Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum program listings are available on the Internet. Visit our website at kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.